Welcome, everyone, to our deep dive. Today, we're jumping into, well, a really foundational passage, Genesis chapter 15.
Specifically, verses 15 through 20.
Right. And this isn't just, you know, an ancient story. It feels like a powerful declaration, almost a dramatic moment where a promise gets sealed.
Absolutely. It's packed with meaning, layers upon layers.
So our mission today, yours and mine, is to kind of peel back those layers. We want to uncover the implications here.
Yeah, we're talking about Abram's personal future, the destiny of his descendants.
And this really astonishing fiery ritual, it sort of flips the script on ancient customs, doesn't it?
It really does. It's a cornerstone passage, I think, setting this unique standard for divine commitment.
Okay, so let's dive in. Let's unpack this, starting with God's words to Abram in verse 15. It begins with comfort, right?
Mm-hmm. You shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age.
Now, on the surface, that sounds nice. Long life, peaceful end. Pretty standard blessing, maybe?
Well, yes and no. When you look at the Hebrew.
Ah, okay, here we go.
The phrase, tabo el tika bishalom. That last part, bishalom. It's translated in peace, but it's richer than that.
Richer how? What are we missing?
It means something more like with wholeness, completeness. It's suggesting Abram's life will end in covenantal shalom.
Covenantal shalom. So not just lack of conflict, but a sense of purpose fulfilled.
Yeah.
Integration.
Exactly. Not chaos, not left hanging, but brought to a, well, a whole and meaningful conclusion within God's plan.
That idea of wholeness for a life, that's powerful, especially for Abram, living this nomadic life with these huge, maybe even distant seeming promises.
It's deeply personal reassurance. You know, put yourself in his shoes, all this uncertainty. Then you hear your life, your end, will have integrity. It'll be whole.
And the text adds, in a good old age.
Right, bojuba. Literally in a good gray-headedness.
Good gray-headedness. I like that.
It evokes that image of old age as a sign of honor, like a silver crown. It's telling him, look, forget Egypt, forget the oppression for a moment. For you, personally,
yeah,
you're going to finish well.
It's amazing. Even amidst these massive history-shaping prophecies, there's this intimate individual assurance. It really shows a focus on the person, not just the grand sweep of history.
Mm-hmm. It anchors the vast promise in personal reality.
Okay, but then the focus does shift, doesn't it? From Abram's personal end to something much bigger, maybe even a bit daunting.
Yes, verse 16 takes a turn.
And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Okay, the fourth generation. Durabi.
That's very specific.
Very specific. It establishes a clear timeline. It's not just someday. It's four generations down the line.
What's the significance of putting a number on it like that?
Well, it signals a delay, first off. They won't return immediately.
Yeah.
But the reason for the delay is what's really striking.
For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.
Exactly. Om Shalom. The iniquity, the guilt, the crookedness. It's not full yet.
So this implies, what, a kind of moral threshold. God is waiting for something. It points to God's patience, but also his justice. The Hebrew origin is about moral distortion, guilt. This isn't God just deciding to, you know, clear out the locals arbitrarily.
He's waiting.
He's waiting until their choices, their collective moral corruption, reaches a certain point, a tipping point, you could say, until their cup is full.
That's a fascinating concept. Divine patience linked directly to human actions, reaching a point of no return, almost. It suggests judgment isn't random or premature.
Precisely. It shows actions have consequences, but there's a divine timetable involved.
Yeah.
It's just even these nations were accountable to a moral standard, and God was allowing things to play out.
A pattern of justice and patience woven into history itself. Okay, so we have personal peace for Abram, a timeline for his descendants linked to the Amorites' actions, mm-hmm. and then comes this incredibly visual, really dramatic moment.
Verse 17. Yeah, this is the peak, I think.
When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. Okay, wow. A smoking fire pot and a flaming torch. What do those symbols scream in this context?
They scream divine presence, loudly. The Hebrew is vivid. Tanur Rajan, a smoking furnace or oven, and Lapid Saj, a flaming torch.
And that imagery, it connects elsewhere.
Yes, absolutely. It powerfully resonates with, well, with Sinai, with the pillar of cloud and fire that guides Israel later. It's an unmistakable sign that God himself is present, actively involved right there.
So not just symbols, but a manifestation. And what they do is key. They passed between these pieces. Pieces of what?
Pieces of the animals Abram had divided earlier as part of setting up this covenant ceremony.
Right. And this act of passing between pieces, That was a known thing in the ancient world.
It was. In ancient Near Eastern treaties, making a covenant often involved cutting animals and both parties walking between the halves.
What did that signify?
It was a self-maledictory oath. Essentially, if I break this covenant, may I become like these pieces. It bound both parties under penalty of death. Super serious stuff.
Okay, so the verb abar, pass between or cross over, is loaded with meaning. But here's the twist.
The twist is huge. Abram doesn't walk between the pieces.
He doesn't. He just watches.
He watches. Instead, it's God himself, symbolized by the smoke and fire, who passes through the path marked by the blood.
Wait, only God?
Only God.
What does that mean, if only one party takes the oath?
It means the covenant is unilateral. It signifies radical grace. The promise, its fulfillment, its security, it rests entirely on God, not on Abram's ability to keep his side of the bargain.
So God is taking the entire obligation, the entire risk, onto himself.
Precisely. Abram's role here is belief. He trusts, and God makes the binding commitment. It completely flips the script on a typical bilateral treaty.
That is astonishing. It's not, if you do this, then I'll do that. It's, I will do this. Full stop.
Exactly. And verse 18 drives it home. On that day, YHWH made a covenant with Abram. The Hebrew is Karat YHWH Beret.
Karat Beret. Cut a covenant.
Literally cut. Mm-hmm. Sealed in blood. But the key is YHWH cut it. God is the sole active party in the sealing. He binds himself to the promise.
While Abram is the recipient, it highlights God's faithfulness over human performance.
Completely. It challenges our usual ideas about contracts needing mutual obligation. Here, the divine party takes it all on.
Wow. Okay, so this incredible covenant is cut, unilaterally sealed by God. What exactly does it promise? We know about Abram's end, the descendant's timeline, but there's more, right? The land.
Oh, yes. Verse 18 continues, "To your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates."
That's a huge territory. River of Egypt to the Euphrates.
It is. Hanahar, Hanagadul, Nahar Parah, the great river, the Euphrates. It essentially encompasses the entire Fertile Crescent. We're talking about a promise on a massive geographical scale.
Far beyond anything Abram controlled or probably even fully grasped at the time.
Absolutely. Sweeping in scale.
And as you mentioned, this land wasn't empty. Verses 19 and 20 list. Let me see. 10 peoples, Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephabenicites.
Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites.
Right. 10 distinct groups. Why list them all out like this?
The text almost rhythms them, like a drum roll. It makes it crystal clear. This isn't just about geography. It's a displacement prophecy.
Displacement prophecy, meaning?
Meaning these 10 nations are the current inhabitants, the lords of the land at that moment. But the listing serves notice. They are essentially placeholders.
Placeholders until?
Until Abram's descendants return, fulfilling that fourth generation timeline, which, remember, was linked to the Amorites' iniquity reaching its fullness. It's all interconnected.
So the listing emphasizes the scope of the future takeover, rooted in the justice aspect we discussed earlier. It's a long-term, detailed plan.
Exactly. It involves specific peoples, specific lands, playing out over generations according to a divine timetable and moral calculus.
Okay, so let's try to pull all these threads together. We've got Abram's personal peace, the descendants' delayed return, the judgment on the Amorites, this incredible unilateral covenant ritual, and the vast land promise involving displacing specific nations. What's the big picture here? What's the ultimate takeaway from this covenant finale?
Well, it paints this multifaceted destiny, all grounded in God's astonishing commitment. You have Abram's personal fate secured, bashalom, wholeness.
Right, peace and a good end for him.
Then, his descendants' path. Hardship, yes, implied by the delay in context, but ultimately guaranteed restoration in that Dorebi, the fourth generation.
Okay.
And the nation's destiny, judgment. But a righteous time judgment when their Oshun Shalem, their iniquity, is complete, not arbitrary.
And underpinning all of it, that moment in the dark.
Absolutely. The foundational piece is that God alone would ever pass between the pieces. That act screams, my promise is unconditional.
The Tanruration and Lapidus, the smoke and fire.
Symbols of his presence, taking the oath upon himself. It makes the covenant dependent solely on his faithfulness, not Abram's, not Israel's future actions. Abram just believes. God Karat Beret, he cuts the covenant binding himself.
It's just incredible. So much depth in these few verses. personal assurance, national prophecy, divine justice, radical grace, all sealed by God acting alone. It truly reshapes how you might think about divine promises.
It really does. It covers the spectrum from the individual to the geopolitical, all resting on this unparalleled act of divine self-commitment. Those Hebrew gems we touched on, Bashalom, Doje Debi, Awushin Shalem, Tanur Ojan, Labidatoi, Abar, Karat Birit, they really unlock the richness here.
What an amazing passage to dive into. It leaves you thinking about the nature of promises, faithfulness.
Yeah.
Both human and divine.
Definitely. And maybe here's a final thought for you, something to chew on after we wrap up.
Okay.
How does this ancient picture, this unilateral, unconditional promise where God takes all the risk, how does that challenge our modern ideas about contracts, about commitment, trust, especially in relationships where maybe one party seems to hold more power?
Mm, that's interesting. Usually we think of contracts as mutual, balanced.
Right. But this suggests a different framework, one perhaps centered on grace and absolute fidelity from the one making the promise. It makes you rethink what commitment can look like, doesn't it? Something to mull over.